knew he should not smile, but he did. Only a moustache, very wispy. You can count the hairs.
How disappointing.
For all her talk about wanting to be mistress of her seat, Selyse Baratheon seemed in no great haste to abandon the comforts of Castle Black for the shadows of the Night Fort. She kept guards, of course, four men posted at the door, two outside on the steps, two inside by the brazier. Commanding them were Sir Patrick of King's Mountain, clad in his knightly raiment of white and blue and silver, his cloak a spatter of five-pointed stars. When presented to Val, the knight sank to one knee to kiss her glove.
"You're even lovelier than I was told, Princess," he declared. "The Queen has told me much and more of your beauty." "How odd, when she has never seen me."
Val patted Sir Patrick on the head.
"Up with you now, Sir Kneeler, up, up."
She sounds as if she were talking to a dog. It was all that John could do not to laugh. Stone-faced, he told the knight that they required audience with the Queen. Sir Patrick sent one of the men-at-arms scrambling up the steps to inquire as to whether Her Grace would receive them.
"The wolf stays here, though,"
Sir Patrick insisted. John expected that. The direwolf made Queen Selyse anxious, almost as much as one wig one dar one. "Ghost, stay." They found Her Grace sewing by the fire, whilst her fool danced about to music only he could hear, the cowbells on his antlers clanging.
"The crow, the crow," Patchface cried when he saw John. "Under the sea, the crows are white as snow. I know, I know. Oh, oh, oh."
Princess Shireen was curled up in a window seat, her hood drawn up to hide the worst of the grayscale that had disfigured her face. There was no sign of Lady Melisandre. For that much, John was grateful. Soon or late, he would need to face the Red Priestess, but he would sooner it was not in the Queen's presence. "Your Grace," he took a knee. Val did likewise. Queen Selyse set aside her sewing.
"You may rise."
"If it please Your Grace, may I present the Lady Val?" Her sister Darla was
mother to that squalling babe who keeps us awake at night. "I know who she is, Lord Snow,"
the Queen sniffed.
"You are fortunate that she returned to us before the King, my husband. Else it might have gone badly for you. Very badly indeed."
"Are you the wildling princess?"
Shireen asked Val.
"Some call me that," said Val. "My sister was wife to Mansurida, the king beyond the wall. She died giving him a son."
"I'm a princess, too," Shireen announced, "but I never had a sister. I used to have a cousin once, before he sailed away. He was just a bastard, but I liked him."
"Honestly, Shireen," her mother said, "I am sure the Lord Commander did not come to hear about Robert's byblows. Patchface, be a good fool, and take the princess to her room."
The bells on his hat rang.
"Away, away," the fool sang. "Come with me beneath the sea. Away, away, away."
He took the little princess by one hand and drew her from the room, skipping. John said, "Your Grace, the leader of the free folk has agreed to my terms." Queen Selyse gave the tiniest of nods.
"It was ever my lord husband's wish to grant sanctuary to these savage peoples. So long as they keep the king's peace and the king's laws, they are welcome in our realm."
She pursed her lips.
"I am told they have more giants with them."
Val answered,
"Almost 200 of them, Your Grace, and more than 80 mammoths."
The queen shuddered.
"Dreadful creatures."
John could not tell if she was speaking of the mammoths or the giants.
"Their such beasts might be useful to my lord husband in his battles."
"That may be, Your Grace," John said, "but the mammoths are too big to pass through our gate."
"Cannot the gate be widened?"
That would be unwise, I think." Selyse sniffed.
"If you say so. No doubt you know about such things. Where do you mean to settle these wildlings? Surely Millstown is not large enough to contain... How many are there?
4,000, Your Grace. They will help us garrison our abandoned castles, the better to defend the wall.
I had been given to understand that those castles were ruins. Dismal places, bleak and cold, hardly more than heaps of rubble. At Eastwatch we heard talk of rats and spiders.
The cold will have killed us spiders by now, thought John, and the rats may be a useful source of meat come winter. All true, Your Grace, but even ruins offer some shelter, and the wall will stand between them and the others.
I see you have considered all this carefully, Lord Snow. I'm sure King Stannis will be pleased when he returns triumphant from his battle.
Assuming he returns at all.
Of course, the Queen went on, the wildlings must first acknowledge Stannis as their king and R'hllor as their god.
And here we are, face to face in the narrow passage. Your Grace, forgive me. Those were not the terms that we agreed to. The Queen's face hardened.
A grievous oversight.
What faint traces of warmth her voice had held vanished all at once. A free folk do not kneel, Val told her.
Then they must be knelt,
the Queen declared.
Do that, Your Grace, and we will rise again at the first chance,
Val promised.
Rise with blades in hand.
The Queen's lips tightened, and her chin gave a small quiver.
You are insolent. I suppose that is only to be expected of a wildling. We must find your husband, who can teach you courtesy.
The Queen turned her glare on John.
I do not approve, Lord Commander, nor will my lord husband. I cannot prevent you from opening your gate, as we both know full well, but I promise you that you shall answer for it when the king returns from battle. Mayhaps you might want to reconsider.
Your Grace, John knelt again. This time Val did not join him. I am sorry my actions have displeased you. I did as I thought best. Do I have your leave to go?
You do. At once.
Once outside and well away from the Queen's men, Val gave vent to her wrath.
You lied about her beard. That one has more hair on her chin than I have between my legs. And the daughter, her face.
Grayscale.
The grey death is what we call it.
It's not always mortal in children.
North of the wall it is. Hemlock is a sure cure. But a pillow or a blade will work as well. If I had given birth to that poor child, I would have given her the gift of mercy long ago.
This was a vow that John had never seen before. Princess Shireen is the Queen's only child.
I pity both of them. The child is not clean.
If Stannis wins his war, Shireen will stand as heir to the Iron Throne.
Then I pity your seven kingdoms.
The maesters say Grayscale is not...
The maesters may believe what they wish. Ask a woods witch if you would know the truth. The grey death sleeps, only to wake again. The child is not clean.
She seems a sweet girl. You cannot know...
I can. You know nothing, Jon Snow.
Val seized his arm.
I want the monster out of there. Him and his wet nurses. You cannot leave them in that same tower as the dead girl.
John shook her hand away.
She is not dead. She is. Her mother cannot see it. Nor you, it seems. Yet death is there.
She walked away from him, stopped, turned back.
I brought you Tormund Giantsbane. Bring me my monster.
If I can, I will.
Do. You owe me a debt, Jon Snow.
John watched her stride away. She is wrong. She must be wrong. Grayscale is not so deadly, she claims, not in children. Ghost was gone again. The sun was low in the west. A cup of hot spiced wine would serve me well just now. Two cups would serve me even better. But they would have to wait. He had foes to face. Foes of the worst sort. Brothers. He found Leathers waiting for him by the winch cage. The two of them rode up together. The higher they went, the stronger the wind. 50 feet up, the heavy cage began to sway with every gust. From time to time, it scraped against the wall, starting small, crystalline showers of ice that sparkled in the sunlight as they fell. They rose above the tallest towers of the castle. At 400 feet, the wind had teeth, and Tor had his black cloak, so it slapped noisily at the iron bars. At 700, it cut right through him. "The wall is mine," John reminded himself, as the winchmen were swinging in the cage. "For 2 more days, at least." John hopped down onto the ice, thanked the men on the winch, and nodded to the spearmen standing sentry. Both wore woolen hoods, pulled down over their heads, so nothing could be seen of their faces but their eyes. But he knew Ty by the tangled rope of greasy black hair falling down his back, and Owen by the sausage stuffed into the scabbard at his hip. He might have known them anyway, just by the way they stood. A good lord must know his men. His father had once told him and Rob, back at Winterfell. John walked to the edge of the wall and gazed down upon the killing ground where Mance Raider's host had died. He wondered where Mance was. "Did he ever find you, little sister? Or were you just a ploy he used, so I would set him free?" It had been so long since he had last seen Arya. What would she look like now? Would he ever know her? Arya Underfoot. Her face was always dirty. Would she still have that little sword he'd had Mickin forge for her? "Stick them with a pointy end," he told her. Wisdom for her wedding night, if half of what he heard of Ramsay Snow was true. "Bring her home, Mance. I saved your son from Melisandre, and now I'm about to save 4,000 of your free folk. You owe me this one little girl." In the haunted forest to the north, the shadows of the afternoon crept through the trees. The western sky was a blaze of red, but to the east the first stars were peeking out. Jon Snow flexed the fingers of his sword hand, remembering all he'd lost. "Sam, you sweet fat fool, you played me a cruel jape when you made me Lord Commander. A Lord Commander has no friends." "Lord Snow," said Leathers, "the cage is coming up." "I hear it." John moved back from the edge. First to make the ascent were the clan chiefs, Flint and Norrie, clad in fur and iron. The Norrie looked like some old fox, wrinkled and slight of build, but sly-eyed and spry. Torgon Flint was half a head shorter, but must have weighed twice as much. A stout, gruff man with gnarled, red-knuckled hands as big as hams, leaning heavily on a blackthorn cane as he limped across the ice. Bowen Marsh came next, bundled up in a bearskin. After him, Athel Yarwick, then Septon Celador, half in his cups. "Walk with me," John told them. They walked west along the wall, down gravel-strewn paths toward the setting sun. When they had come 50 yards from the warming shed, he said, "You know why I've summoned you? 3 days hence at dawn, the gate will open to allow Tormund and his people through the wall. There is much we need to do in preparation." Silence greeted his pronouncement. Then Athel Yarwick said, "Lord Commander, there are thousands of scrawny wildlings, bone-weary, hungry, far from home." John pointed the lights of their campfires. "There they are. 4,000, Tormund claims.
3,000, I make them by the fires."
Bowen Marsh lived for counts and measures.
"More than twice that number at Hardhome, with the Woods Witch, we are told. And Sir Dennis writes of great camps in the mountains beyond the Shadow Tower."
John did not deny it. Tormund says the Weeper means to try the Bridge of Skulls again. The old pomegranate touched his scar. He had gotten it defending the Bridge of Skulls, the last time the Weeping Man had tried to cut his way across the gorge. Surely the Lord Commander cannot mean to allow that demon through as well. Not gladly. John had not forgotten the heads the Weeping Man had left him, with bloody holes where their eyes had been. Black Jack Bulwer, Hairy Hal, Garth Greyfeather. I cannot avenge them, but I will not forget their names. But yes, my lord, him as well. We cannot pick and choose amongst the free folk, saying this one may pass, this one may not. Peace means peace for all. The Denari hawked and spat.
As well make peace with wolves and carrion crows. It's peaceful in my dungeons, grumbled old Flint. Give the Weeping Man to me.
How many rangers has the Weeper killed? Asked Othel Jarvik. How many women has he raped or killed or stolen?
Three of mine own ilk, said old Flint, and he blinds the girls he does not take.
When a man takes the black, his crimes are forgiven, John reminded them. If we want the free folk to fight beside us, we must pardon their past crimes as we would for our own.
The Weeper will not say the words, insisted Jarvik. He will not wear the cloak. Even other raiders do not trust him.
You need not trust a man to use him. Else how could I make use of all of you? We need the Weeper and others like him. Who knows the wild better than a wildling? Who knows our foes better than a man who has fought them?
All the Weeper knows is rape and murder, said Jarvik.
Once past the wall, the wildlings will have thrice our numbers, said Bowen Marsh. And that is only Tormund's band. Add the Weeper's men and those at Hard Home, and they will have the strength to end the Night's Watch in a single night.
Numbers alone do not win a war. You have not seen them. Half them are dead on their feet.
I would sooner have them dead in the ground, said Jarvik. If it please, my lord.
It does not please me. John's voice was as cold as the wind snapping at their cloaks. There are children in that camp, hundreds of them, thousands. Women as well. Spear wives, some, along with mothers and grandmothers, widows and maids. Would you condemn them all to die, my lord?
Brothers should not squabble, Septon Celador said. Let us kneel and pray to the crone to light our way to wisdom.
Lord Snow, said the Denari. Where do you mean to put these wildlings of yours? Not in my lands, I hope.
Aye, declared old Flint. You want them in their gift? That's your folly. But see they don't wander off, or I'll send you back their heads. Winter is nigh. I want no more mouths to feed.
The wildlings will remain upon the wall, John assured them. Most will be housed in one of our abandoned castles. The watch now had garrisons at Icemark, Longbarrow, Sable Hall, Greyguard, and Deep Lake, all badly undermanned, but 10 castles still stood empty and abandoned. Men with wives and children, all orphan girls and any orphan boys below the age of 10, old women, widowed mothers, any woman who does not care to fight. The spear wives were sent to Longbarrow to join their sisters. Single men to the other forts we've reopened. Those who take the black will remain here, or be posted to Eastwatch or the Shadow Tower. Tormund will take Oakenshield as his seat, to keep him close at hand. Bowen Marsh sighed.
If they do not slay us with their swords, they will do so with their mouths. Pray, how does the Lord Commander propose to feed Tormund and his thousands?
John had anticipated that question. Through Eastwatch, we will bring in food by ship, as much as might be required, from the Riverlands and the Stormlands and the Vale of Erin, from Dorne and the Reach, across the narrow sea from the Free Cities.
And this food will be paid for how, if I may ask?
with gold from the iron bank of Bravos. John might have replied. Instead, he said, I have agreed that the free folk may keep their furs and pelts. They will need those for warmth when winter comes. All other wealth they must surrender. Gold and silver, amber, gemstones, carvings, anything of value. We will ship it all across the narrow sea to be sold in the free cities.
All the wealth of the wildlings, said the Nuri. That should buy you a bushel of barleycorn. 2 bushels, might be.
Lord Commander, why not demand that the wildlings give up their arms as well?
Asked Clytus. Leathers laughed at that.
You want the free folk to fight beside you against a common foe. How are we to do that without arms? Would you have us throw snowballs at the whites? Or will you give us sticks to hit them with?
The arms most wildlings carry are little more than sticks, thought John. Wooden clubs, stone axes, mauls, spears with fire-hardened points, knives of bone and stone and dragon glass, wisher shields, bone armor, boiled leather. The Thens worked bronze, and raiders, like the Weeper, carried stolen steel and iron swords, looted off some corpse. But even those were oft of ancient vintage, dinted from years of hard use and spotted with rust. Tormund Giantsbane will never willingly disarm his people, John said. He is not the weeping man, but he is no craven either. If I had asked that of him, it would have come to blood. The Nuri fingered his beard.
You may put your wildlings in these ruined ports, Lord Snow, but how will you make them stay? What is there to stop them moving south to fairer, warmer lands?
Our lands, said old Flint.
Tormund has given me his oath. He will serve with us until the spring. The Weeper and their other captains will swear the same, or we will not let them pass. Old Flint shook his head.
They will betray us.
The Weeper's word is worthless, said Othel Yarwick.
These are godless savages, said Septon Celador. Even in the south, the treachery of wildlings is renowned.
Leathers crossed his arms across his chest.
That battle below. I was on t'other side, remember? Now I'll wear your blacks and train your boys to kill. Some might call me turncoat. Might be so. But I'm no more savage than you crows. We have guards, too. The same guards they keep in Winterfell.
The guards of the north, since before this wall was raised, said John. Those are the guards that Tormund swore by. He will keep his word. I know him, as I know Mance Rayder. I marched with him for a time, you may recall.
I had not forgotten, said the Lord Steward.
No, thought John, I did not think you had.
Mance Rayder swore an oath as well, Marsh went on. He vowed to wear no crowns, take no wife, father no sons. Then he turned his cloak, did all those things, and led a fearsome host against the realm. It is the remnants of that host that waits beyond the wall.
Broken remnants.
A broken sword can be reforged. A broken sword can kill.
The free folk have neither laws nor lords, John said. But they love their children. Will you admit that much?
It is not their children who concern us. We fear the fathers, not the sons.
As do I. So I insisted upon hostages. I'm not the trusting fool you take me for, nor am I half-wildly, no matter what you believe. 100 boys between the ages of 8 and 16. A son from each of their chiefs and captains. The rest chosen by lot. The boys will serve as pages and squires, freeing our own men for other duties. Some may choose to take the black one day. Queerer things have happened. The rest will stand hostage for the loyalty of their sires. The Northmen glanced at one another.
Hostages, mused the Nuri. Tormund has agreed to this.
It was that, or watch his people die. My blood price, he called it, said John Snow. But he will pay.
Aye, and why not?
Old Flint stumped his cane against the ice.
Wargs, we always called them. When Winterfell demanded boys of us, but they were hostages, and none the worse for it.
None but them whose sires displeased the kings of Winter, said the Norrie. Those came home short of my head. So you tell me, boy, if these wildling friends of yours prove false, do ye have the belly to do what needs to be done?
Asked Janus Slint. Tormund Giantsbane knows better than to try me. I may seem a green boy in your eyes, Lord Norrie, but I am still a son of Eddard Stark. Yet even that did not appease his Lord Steward.
You say these boys will serve as squires. Surely the Lord Commander does not mean they will be trained at arms?
John's anger flared. No, my lord, I mean to set them to sewing lacy small clothes. Of course they shall be trained at arms. They shall also churn butter, hew firewood, muck stables, empty chamber pots, and run messages, and in between they will be drilled with spear and sword and longbow. Marsh flushed a deeper shade of red.
The Lord Commander must pardon my bluntness, but I have no softer way to say this. What you propose is nothing less than treason. For 8,000 years, the men of the Night's Watch have stood upon the wall and fought these wildlings. Now you mean to let them pass, to shelter them in our castles, to feed them and clothe them, and teach them how to fight. Lord Snow, must I remind you? You swore an oath.
I know what I swore. John said the words. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men. Were those the same words you said when you took your vows?
They were, as the Lord Commander knows.
Are you certain that I have not forgotten some, the ones about the king and his laws, and how we must defend every foot of his land and cling to each ruined castle? How does that part go? John waited for an answer. None came. I am the shield that guards the realms of men. Those are the words. So tell me, my lord, what are these wildlings, if not men? Bowen Marsh opened his mouth. No words came out. A flush crept up his neck. John Snow turned away. The last light of the sun had begun to fade. He watched the cracks along the wall go from red to grey to black, from streaks of fire to rivers of black ice. Down below, Lady Melisandre would be lighting her night fire and chanting,
Lord of Light, defend us, for the night is dark and full of terrors.
Winter is coming, John said at last, breaking the awkward silence. And with it, the White Walkers. The wall is where we stop them. The wall was made to stop them. But the wall must be manned. This discussion is at an end. We have much to do before the gate is opened. Tormund and his people will need to be fed and clothed and housed. Some are sick and will need nursing. Those will fall to you, Clydus. Save as many as you can. Clydus blinked his dim pink eyes.
I will do my best, John. My lord, I mean.
We will need every cart and wagon made ready to transport the free folk to their new homes. Athel, you shall see to that. Jarvik grimaced. Aye, Lord Commander. Lord Bowen, you shall collect the tolls. The gold and silver, the amber, the torques, and armbands and necklaces. Sort it all, count it. See that it reaches Eastwatch safely.
Yes, Lord Snow, said Bowen Marsh.
And John thought, ice, she said. and daggers in the dark. Blood frozen red and hard and naked steel. His sword hand flexed. The wind was rising. Circe. Each night seemed colder than the last. The cell had neither fireplace nor brazier. The only window was too high to allow her a view, and too small to squeeze through, but more than large enough to let in the chill. Circe had torn up the first shift they gave her, demanding the return of her own clothes, but that only left her naked and shivering. When they bought her another shift, she pulled it down over her head and thanked them, choking upon the words. The window let in sounds as well. That was the only way the queen had to know what might be happening in the city. The scepters who brought her food would tell her nothing. She hated that. Jamie would be coming for her, but how would she know when he arrived? Circe only hoped he was not so foolish as to go racing ahead of his army. He would need every sword to deal with the ragged horde of poor fellows surrounding the great sept. She asked about her twin often, but her jailers gave no answer. She asked about Sir Loras, too. At last report, the Knight of Flowers had been dying on Dragonstone of wounds received whilst taking the castle.
"Let him die," Circe thought, "and let him be quick about it."
The boy's death would mean an empty place on the king's guard, and that might be her salvation. But the scepters were as close-mouthed about Loras Tyrell as they were about Jaime. Lord Kyburn had been her last and only visitor. Her world had a population of four, herself and her three jailers, pious and unyielding. Scepter Eunella was big-boned and mannish, with callous hands and homely, scowling features. Scepter Moel had stiff white hair and small, mean eyes, perpetually crinkled in suspicion, peering out of a wrinkled face as sharp as a blade of an axe. Scepter Scalera was thick-waisted and short, with heavy breasts, olive skin, and a sour smell to her, like milk on the verge of going bad. They brought her food and water, emptied her chamber pot, and took away her shift for washing every few days, leaving her to huddle naked under her blanket until it was returned to her. Sometimes Calera would read to her from the Seven-Pointed Star or the Book of Holy Prayer, but elsewise none of them would speak with her or answer any of her questions. She hated and despised all three of them, almost as much as she hated and despised the men who had betrayed her. False friends, treacherous servants, men who had professed undying love, even her own blood, all of them, had deserted her in her hour of need. Usne Kettleblack, that weakling, had broken beneath the lash, filling the High Sparrow's ears with secrets he should have taken to his grave. His brothers, scum of the streets, whom she had raised high, did no more than sit upon their hands. Urien Walters, her admiral, had fled to sea with the Drummond she had built for him. Orton Merryweather had gone running back to Longtable, taking his wife Tainer, who had been the Queen's one true friend in these terrible times. Harris Swift and Grand Maester Pycelle had abandoned her to captivity and offered the realm to the very men who had conspired against her. Merrin Trant and Boris Blunt, the King's sworn protectors, were nowhere to be found. Even her cousin Lancel, who once had claimed to love her, was one of her accusers. Her uncle had refused to help her rule when she would have made him the king's hand. And Jaime? No. That she could not believe, would not believe. Jaime would be here once he knew of her plight. "Come at once," she had written to him. "Help me. Save me. I need you now as I have never needed you before. I love you. I love you. I love you. Come at once." Kyburn had sworn that he would see that her letter reached her twin,
off in the Riverlands with his army. Qyburn had never returned, however. For all she knew, he might be dead, his head impaled upon a spike above the city keep's gates. Or perhaps he was languishing in one of the black cells beneath the red keep, her letter still unsent. The queen had asked after him 100 times, but her captors would not speak of him. All she knew, for certain, was that Jamie had not come.
"Not yet," she told herself, "but soon, and once he comes, the High Sparrow and his bitches will sing a different song."
She hated feeling helpless. She had threatened, but her threats had been received with stony faces and deaf ears. She had commanded, but her commands had been ignored. She had invoked the mother's mercy, appealing to the natural sympathy of one woman for another. But the three shriveled scepters must have put their womanhood aside when they spoke their vows. She had tried charm, speaking to them gently, accepting each new outrage meekly. They were not swayed. She had offered them rewards, promised leniency, honours, gold, positions at court. They treated her promises as they did her threats. And she had prayed. Oh, how she had prayed! Prayer was what they wanted, so she served it to them, served it on her knees as if she were some common trollop of the streets and not a daughter of the rock. She had prayed for relief, for deliverance, for Jamie. Loudly she asked the gods to defend her in her innocence. Silently she prayed for her accusers to suffer sudden, painful deaths. She prayed until her knees were raw and bloody, until her tongue felt so thick and heavy that she was like to choke on it. All the prayers they had taught her as a girl came back to Circe in her cell, and she made up new ones as needed, calling on the mother and the maiden, on the father and the warrior, on the crone and the smith. She had even prayed to the stranger, "Any god in a storm?" The seven proved as deaf as their earthly servants. Circe gave them all the words that she had in her, gave them everything but tears. "That they will never have," she told herself. She hated feeling weak. If the gods had given her the strength they gave Jamie and that swaggering oaf, Robert, she could have made her own escape. "Oh, for a sword, and the skill to wield it!" She had a warrior's heart, but the gods in their blind malice had given her the feeble body of a woman. The queen had tried to fight them early on, but the scepters had overwhelmed her. There were too many of them, and they were stronger than they looked. Ugly old women, every one of them, but all that praying and scrubbing and beating novices with sticks had left them tough as roots. And they would not let her rest. Night or day, whenever the queen closed her eyes to sleep, one of her captors would appear to wake her and demand that she confess her sins. She stood accused of adultery, fornication, high treason, even murder, for Usne Kettleblack had confessed to smothering the last High Septon at her command.
"I'm come to hear you tell of all your murders and fornications,"
Scepter Unella would growl when she shook the queen awake. Scepter Moel would tell her that it was her sins that kept her sleepless.
"Only the innocent know the peace of untroubled sleep. Confess your sins, and you will sleep like a newborn babe."
Wake and sleep and wake again. Every night was broken into pieces by the rough hands of her tormentors, and every night was colder and crueler than the night before. The hour of the owl, the hour of the wolf, the hour of the nightingale, moonrise and moonset, dusk and dawn, they staggered past like drunkards. What hour was it? What day was it? Where was she? Was this a dream, or had she woken? The little shards of sleep that they allowed her turned into razors, slicing at her wits. Each day found her duller than the day before, exhausted and feverish.
She had lost all sense of how long she had been imprisoned in this cell, high up in one of the seven towers of the great sept of Baelor. "I will grow old and die here," she thought, despairing. Cersei could not allow that to happen. Her son had need of her. The realm had need of her. She had to free herself, no matter what the risk. Her world had shrunk to a cell, 6 feet square, a chamber pot, a lumpy pallet, and a brown wool blanket, thin as hope, that made her skin itch. But she was still Lord Tywin's heir, a daughter of the Rock. Exhausted by her lack of sleep, shivering from the cold that stole into the tower cell each night, feverish and famished by turns, Cersei came at last to know she must confess. That night, when Septa Eunella came to wrench her out of sleep, she found the queen waiting on her knees. "I have sinned," said Cersei. Her tongue was thick in her mouth, her lips raw and chapped. "I have sinned most grievously. I see that now. How could I have been so blind for so long? The crone came to me with her lamp raised high, and by its holy light I saw the road that I must walk. I want to be clean again. I want only absolution. Please, good Scepter, I beg of you, take me to the High Septon so that I might confess my crimes and fornications." "I will tell him, your grace," said Scepter Eunella. "His High Holiness will be most pleased. Only through confession and true repentance may our immortal souls be saved." And for the rest of that long night, they let her sleep. Hours and hours of blessed sleep. The owl and the wolf and the nightingale slipped by for once, with their passage unseen and unremarked, while Cersei dreamed a long, sweet dream where Jaime was her husband and their son was still alive. Come morning, the queen felt almost like herself again. When her captors came for her, she made pious noises at them again, and told them how determined she was to confess her sins and be forgiven for all that she had done.
"We rejoice to hear it," said Septa Moel. "It will be a great weight off your soul," said Septa Scalera. "You will feel much better afterwards, your grace."
"Your grace?" Those two simple words thrilled her. During her long captivity, her jailers had not oft-bothered with even that simple courtesy.
"His High Holiness awaits," said Scepter Eunella.
Cersei lowered her head, humble and obedient.
"Might I be allowed to bathe first? I am in no fit state to attend him."
"You may wash later, if His High Holiness allows," said Scepter Eunella. "It is the cleanliness of your immortal soul that should concern you now, not such vanities of the flesh."
The three scepters led her down the tower stairs, with Scepter Eunella going before her, and Scepter Moel and Scepter Scalera at her heels, as if they were afraid she might try to flee.
"It has been so long since I have had a visitor," Cersei murmured in a quiet voice as they made their descent. "Is the king well? I ask only as a mother fearful for her child." "His grace is in good health," said Scepter Scalera, "and well protected day and night. The queen is with him always."
"I am the queen," she swallowed, smiled, and said. "That is good to know. Tommen loves her so. I never believed those terrible things that were said of her." Had Margaery Tyrell somehow wriggled free of the accusations of fornication, adultery, and high treason? Was there a trial?
"Soon," said Scepter Scalera. "But her brother—"
"Hush!"
Scepter Eunella turned to glare back over her shoulder at Scalera.
"You chatter too much, you foolish old woman. It's not for us to speak of such things."
Scalera lowered her head.
"Pray forgive me."
They made the rest of the descent in silence. The High Sparrow
received her in his sanctum, an austere seven-sided chamber where crudely carved faces of the seven stared out from the stone walls with expressions almost as sour and disapproving as his high holiness himself. When she entered, he was seated behind a rough-hewn table, writing. The High Septon had not changed since the last time she had been in his presence, the day he had her seized and imprisoned. He was still a scrawny, grey-haired man with a lean, hard, half-starved look, his face sharp-featured, lined, his eyes suspicious. In place of the rich robes of his predecessors, he wore a shapeless tunic of undyed wool that fell down to his ankles.
"Your Grace," he said by way of greeting, "I understand that you wish to make confession."
Cersei dropped to her knee.
"I do, High Holiness. The crone came to me as I slept with her lamp held high." "To be sure. Yunella, you will stay and make a record of Her Grace's words. Sclera, Moel, you have my leave to go."
He pressed the fingers of his hands together, the same gesture she had seen her father use 1,000 times. Septa Yunella took a seat behind her, spread out a parchment, dipped a quill in Maester's ink. Cersei felt a stab of fright.
"Once I have confessed, will I be permitted to—"
"Your Grace shall be dealt with according to your sins."
"This man is implacable,"
she realized once again. She gathered herself for a moment. "Mother, have mercy on me, then. I have lain with men outside the bonds of marriage. I confess it."
"Who?"
The High Septon's eyes were fixed on hers. Cersei could hear Yunella writing behind her. Her quill made a faint, soft scratching sound.
"Lancel Lannister, my cousin, and Osney Kettleblack."
Both men had confessed to bedding her. It would do her no good to deny it.
"His brothers, too, both of them."
She had no way of knowing what Osfried and Osmond might say. Safer to confess too much than too little.
"It does not excuse my sin, High Holiness. But I was lonely and afraid. The gods took King Robert from me, my love and my protector. I was alone, surrounded by schemers, false friends, and traitors who were conspiring at the death of my children. I did not know who to trust, so I used the only means that I had to bind the Kettleblacks to me."
"By which you mean your female part?"
"My flesh."
She pressed a hand to her face, shuddering. When she lowered it again, her eyes were wet with tears.
"Yes, may the maid forgive me. It was for my children, though, for the realm. I took no pleasure in it. The Kettleblacks, they are hard men and cruel, and they use me roughly. But what else was I to do? Tommen needed men around him I could trust."
"His Grace was protected by the King's Guard."
"The King's Guard stood by useless, as his brother Joffrey died, murdered at his own wedding feast. I watched one son die. I could not bear to lose another. I have sinned. I have committed wanton fornication. But I did it for Tommen. Forgive me, High Holiness, but I would open my legs for every man in King's Landing, if that was what I had to do to keep my children safe."
"Forgiveness comes only from the gods. What of Sir Lancel, who was your cousin and your lord husband's squire? Did you take him into your bed to win his loyalty as well?"
"Lancel."
Cersei hesitated. "Careful," she told herself. "Lancel would have told him everything."
"Lancel loved me. He was half a boy, but I never doubted his devotion to me, oh, my son."
"And yet you still corrupted him."
"I was lonely." She choked back a sob. "I had lost my husband, my son, my lord father. I was regent, but a queen is still a woman, and women are weak vessels, easily tempted. Your High Holiness knows the truth of that. Even holy scepters have been known to sin. I took comfort with Lancel.
He was kind and gentle, and I needed someone. It was wrong, I know, but I had no one else. A woman needs to be loved. She needs a man beside her. She
began to sob uncontrollably. The High Septon made no move to comfort her. He sat there, with his hard eyes fixed on her, watching her weep, as stony as the statues of the seven in the sept above. Long moments passed, but finally her tears were all dried up. By then her eyes were red and raw from crying, and she felt as if she might faint. The High Sparrow was not done with her, however.
"These are common sins," he said. "The wickedness of widows is well known, and all women are wantons at heart, given to using their wiles and their beauty to work their wills on men. There is no treason here. So long as you did not stray from your marriage bed, whilst His Grace King Robert was still alive."
"Never," she whispered, shivering. "Never, I swear it."
He paid that no mind.
"There are other charges laid against your Grace, crimes far more grievous than simple fornications. You admit Sir Osney Kettleblack was your lover, and Sir Osney insists that he smothered my predecessor at your behest. He further insists that he bore false witness against Queen Marjorie and her cousins, telling tales of fornications, adultery, and high treason, again at your behest."
"No," said Cersei, "it is not true. I love Marjorie as I would a daughter, and the other... I complained to the High Septon, I admit it. He was Tyrion's creature, weak and corrupt, a stain upon our holy faith. Your High Holiness knows that as well as I. It may be that Osney thought that his death would please me. If so, I bear some part of the blame, but murder? No. Of that I am innocent. Take me to the sept, and I will stand before the Father's judgment seat and swear the truth of that."
"In time," said the High Septon. "You also stand accused of conspiring at the murder of your own Lord Husband, our late beloved King Robert, first of his name."
"Lancel," Cersei thought, "Robert was killed by a boar. Do they say I'm a skin changer now? A warg? Am I accused of killing Joffrey too? My own sweet son? My firstborn?"
"No, just your husband. Do you deny it?"
"I deny it, I do. Before gods and men, I deny it." He nodded.
"Last of all, and worst of all, there are some who say your children were not fathered by King Robert, that they are bastards born of incest and adultery."
"Stannis says that," Cersei said at once. "A lie, a lie, a palpable lie. Stannis wants the Iron Throne for himself, but his brother's children stand in his way, so he must needs claim that they are not his brothers. That filthy letter, there's no shred of truth to it. I deny it."
The High Septon placed both hands flat upon the table and pushed himself to his feet.
"Gilt, Lord Stannis has turned from the truth of the seven to worship a red demon, and his false faith has no place in these seven kingdoms."
That was almost reassuring. Cersei nodded.
"Even so,"
His High Holiness went on,
"these are terrible charges, and the realm must know the truth of them. If your Grace has told it true, no doubt a trial will prove your innocence."
"A trial still? I have confessed."
"To certain sins I, others you deny. Your trial will separate the truths from the falsehoods. I shall ask the seven to forgive the sins you have confessed, and pray that you will be found innocent of these other accusations."
Cersei rose slowly from her knees.
"I bow to the wisdom of your High Holiness," she said. "But if I might beg for just one drop of the mother's mercy, It has been so long since I last saw my son. Please?
The old man's eyes were chips of flint.
It would not be fitting to allow you near the king until you have been cleansed of all your wickedness. You have taken the first step on your path back to righteousness, however, and in the light of that I shall permit you other visitors, one each day.
The queen began to weep again. This time the tears were true.
You are too kind. Thank you.
The mother is merciful. It is her you should thank.
Moel and Scalera were waiting to lead her back up to her tower cell. Yunella followed close behind them.
We have all been praying for your grace, Scepter Moel said, as they were climbing.
Yes, Scepter Scalera echoed, and you must feel so much lighter now, clean and innocent as a maid on the morning of her wedding.
I fucked Jamie on the morning of my wedding, the queen recalled.
I do, she said. I feel reborn, as if a festering boil has been lanced, and now at last I can begin to heal. I could almost fly.
She imagined how sweet it would be to slam an elbow into Scepter Scalera's face and send her careening down the spiral steps. If the guards were good, the wrinkled old cunt might crash into Scepter Yunella and take her down with her.
It is good to see you smiling again, Scalera said. His High Holiness said I might have visitors.
He did, said Scepter Yunella. If your grace will tell us whom you wish to see, we will send word to them.
Jamie, I need Jamie. But if her twin was in a city, why did he not come to her? It might be wiser to wait on Jamie until she had a better notion of what was happening beyond the walls of the great Scepter Baelor.
My uncle, she said, Sir Kevin Lannister, my father's brother, is he in the city?
He is, said Scepter Yunella. The Lord Regent has taken up residence in the Red Keep. We will send for him at once.
Thank you, said Cersei, thinking, Lord Regent, is it?
She could not pretend to be surprised. A humble and a contrite heart proved to have benefits over and beyond cleansing the soul of sin. That night the queen was moved to a larger cell 2 floors down, with a window she could actually look out of, and warm soft blankets for her bed. And when time came for supper, instead of stale bread and oaten porridge, she was served a roast capon, a bowl of crisp greens sprinkled with crushed walnuts, and a mound of mashed neeps aswim in butter. That night she crawled into her bed with a full stomach for the first time since she was taken, and slept through the black watches of the night undisturbed. The next morning, with the dawn, there came her uncle. Cersei was still at her breakfast when the door swung open, and Sir Kevin Lannister stepped through. "Leave us," he told her jailers. Scepter Moel ushered Scalera and Yunella away and closed the door behind them. The queen rose to her feet. Sir Kevin looked older than when she had seen him last. He was a big man, broad in the shoulder and thick about the waist, with a close-cropped blond beard that followed the line of his heavy jaw and short blond hair in full retreat from his brow. A heavy woolen cloak, dyed crimson, was clasped at one shoulder with a golden brooch in the shape of a lion's head.
"I thank you for coming," the queen said.
Her uncle frowned.
"You should sit. There are things that I must needs tell you."
She did not want to sit.
"You are still angry with me. I hear it in your voice. Forgive me, uncle. It was wrong of me to throw my wine at you, but
you think I care about a cup of wine? Lancel is my son, Cersei, your own nephew. If I am angry with you, that is the cause. You should have looked after him, guided him, found him a likely girl of good family. Instead, you—"
"I know, I know. Lancel wanted me more than I ever wanted him,"
He still does, I will wager.
I was alone, weak. Please, Uncle, oh, Uncle, it is so good to see your face, your sweet, sweet face. I have done wicked things, I know.